right, welcome back, Red Ice members. Thank you very much for joining us here for the second hour of our discussion with Nick Pelling. And we are, of course, talking about the Voynich manuscript, ciphers, cryptography, steganography, secrets, and even architecture as well. And I want to ask you a little bit here about the cryptography and the relationship, I guess, to today's kind of digital era. And if you think there's anything we can learn from ciphers and so forth when it comes to safer data communication, and do you think that even a ciphering language containing the Voynich manuscript, for instance, could lead to a new type of encrypting when it comes to data and so forth?
I've looked at the Voynich manuscript cipher system for a long time now, and even though I can't break it, I can say how it's made up. And the thing that strikes me again and again is that it has a kind of architectural structured quality to it, that it's not just one simple cipher or one very complex cipher. It's a number of lots of little ciphers all arranged together within a certain kind of arrangement. Now, that's a very strange way of making ciphers, because mostly people look for one single killer cipher trick that can't be broken. And usually they have a great idea, and then mathematicians go, well, actually, we can break that. Sorry about that. Okay, end of that story. But this is different. This is lots of little ones all merged together. Now, up until about 20 years ago, you didn't really see any ciphers like that at all. But you're now starting to see some quite complex ciphers formed from lots of little parts that have between them a very kind of hard-to-break quality that's not entirely dissimilar to what you see in the Voynich, insofar as it's lots of different bits all chained together in different ways. And I think that's kind of a very similar sort of approach, insofar as it's not looking for a single killer solution. It's kind of amassing a lot of smaller solutions together in a tricky sort of way.
Yes, and that will be much more difficult to unravel such a thing, right?
Well, the way that cryptology works is that modern cryptologists define systems, reflexive systems, in terms of cryptographic systems where you know everything about it in the first place. So they never try and break something from scratch. They say, how complex is it if you know everything about it? Now, in the case of the Voynich manuscript, we don't know everything about it, and so we can't use those kind of modern metrics. And in the end, there's a very high chance that once you kind of get it, that the Voynich will turn out to be very simple, but just cunning. Whereas what they're looking for in modern cryptography is a kind of more mathematical intractability, from just a lot of stuff tied together in very obscure ways, mathematically obscure ways.
Yeah.
So I think they kind of learnt the lesson that wanted to be learned from it before it was their time, which is that you can get high complexity out of simple parts if you arrange them in just the right sort of way.
How about again, if we talk about some of the components inside, and maybe even some of the people that have been studying the manuscript. From an alchemical point of view, there seems to be a lot of alchemists, and also many people have given the whole manuscript a kind of alchemical interpretation. Have you studied anything at all in regards to that, or have you kind of just stayed out of that whole genre?
Well, I know. It's one of those things with every single type of lead, I come back to a thing which I call basically the evidence, which is not what's possible, but what it is. And yes, you can say it's possible that the Voynich has some kind of alchemy in it. It's entirely possible. But you have to admit that there's nothing that leads you there from the pictures. Nothing at all. Alchemical books had a very stylized representation of how they showed things. Flasks had certain things. There was a king and a queen and a red lion and a green lion and all the different things that had very much. And now, you can look at elements of the Voynich manuscript and say, oh yes, in the second pharmacological section, there is what appears to be a green line in the roots. Oh, yes. In the first section, there is a dragon, a tiny little dragon in one of the pictures, and that might have something to do with it. But you are struggling. There's no, like, consistent sort of visual key that says, that calls out alchemy. One of the leading experts in the field of, history of alchemy is a Scottish guy called Adam McLean. And he's looked for the Wandish Manuscript for years and years because people keep saying, it has to be alchemy, it has to be alchemy. Mm-hmm. And he says, from having looked at 10,000 other alchemy books, he can't see the link. And I have to say, I guess he's probably right. He really has seen a lot.
Okay, okay.
There's nothing there.
And what are some of the other basic theories out there that the Voynich manuscript talks about? You know, have you studied the other one out there as well? You know, some of the, if we go from the fringe all the way up to the more kind of boring.
Oh, of course, yeah. The most important theory of the last few years was put forward by English academic Gordon Rugg. And he said, here's a way using tables that someone could have created text like Voynich is. Now, I used to work in computer games for many years,
mm-hmm.
and a little table is a real key AI trick. When you want to make your little men running around look as though they're intelligent, what you do is you encode little rules into tables. And one short table can make someone look really intelligent in the context of what they're doing, and very, very purposeful, even though it's actually very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of occasions where you can create quite complex mathematical tricks out of tables. Now, what he said was, here's a set of tables that seems to generate stuff quite like Voynich is. And he linked them with what are called Cardan grills, which were used for hiding things. If you have a big table of text that's very regularly laid out, and you have little holes in a kind of mask that goes on top, and you just read the words that peek through the mask, you can hide sentences in a page full of nonsense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, and he said, well, you can use the same sort of thing to drive this kind of table mechanism to get this sort of thing. All very well. It's possible. Unfortunately, the Voynich manuscript appears to have been around a century before Cardan. And the central idea of the Cardan grill is that you have a very serial printed page kind of layout, which you plainly don't have in the Voynich. There's no evidence that the person creating the Voynich had a very print-centric frame of mind, which ties in with the 1450 to 1500 kind of dating, because books weren't the force they are now, or even though they became in the 16th century even. So it's a great theory, and his observation says if the manuscript was made around the time of the late 16th century, then it could have used this Cardan grill type trick to generate text. But it's nonsense, because it was around like a century before. So that's where the logic kind of dissolves, and it becomes a fairly meaningless thought experiment. That had it been made a century later than it was made, it might have been made with this technique. But it wasn't. Mm. So it wasn't. The problem with Gordon Rugg is that he had this article published in Nature, Scientific American, a lot of mainstream magazines picked up, and The Guardian, and all your newspapers around the world.
Mm.
And from there, there's become this the cult of the hoax. The idea that the Voynich was a hoax, as I recall, was has been put forward many times, most famous in the early 70s. So it's an old idea. And the idea that it might have been Dee and Kelly hoaxing it, again, comes from the 70s too.
Okay.
But all that Gordon Rugg did was basically take a bad idea and show how it might have worked. But unfortunately, it's still a bad idea. And so the vast majority of people who have heard of the Voynich in the last few years, not before, kind of say, well, I thought I heard it was a hoax. Mm. But actually it was just an article that didn't quite get the logic right.
And that's very common, though, how things are kind of injected into the mainstream in a way. And you know, there's a whole lot more to study there, but we're not shown that evidence. And we often end up in that area, in that area.
It's very often that a good story holds today. And, you know, the idea that the Voynich is just meaningless nonsense is a great story. It's very postmodern. Mm. The idea that it's meaningless. Oh, that's the key. And that ties in with a whole lot of linguistic theories of the 70s and 80s that, you know, that we kind of struggle, we fight against nonsense, but ultimately our language is fairly hollow. But it's a very pessimistic view of life. And,
indeed.
But Gordon Rugg's stuff kind of taps into that, unfortunately.
Okay. And how about some of the other, you know, other ideas out there about... The fact that it contains the secrets of the universe, pretty much, and secrets of not only alchemy but also herbal knowledge that you mentioned before. It shows astronomical signs and zodiacal constellations and things like that. Does any of that kind of hold up or stand up in regards to what you've been studying and researching?
Certainly, in the astronomical section, there are stuff that look to me just like kinds of calendars. Now, again, you have to remember that the pages, as we see them now, aren't in the right order. And in the astronomical section, which is Quire 9 mainly, it's not only in the wrong order, it's been the binding's been lost, and it's been rebound along the wrong fold. And you can see all the binding marks on the fold where it isn't bound now.
Mm.
So if you go back to where how it was originally bound, what you find is that there's a beautiful picture of a circular picture with the sun that originally sat next to a picture of the moon, and one has eight divisions, which is the solar calendar, and the moon has 12 divisions. Now this is kind of strange, because you have to remember that astrology back in the 14th, 15th centuries, was very much based around the moon.
Yes.
The modern idea of astrology as a kind of a solar thing, your sun sign, it wasn't really the order of the day. Astrologers thought the sun signs were just a distraction. They were more interested in what the moon was doing, because the moon moved so fast that actually it was sensitive enough to pick up on where things are, they believed. So... it's quite interesting that you have these two different calendars. And there's another page right before them, which appears to have a kind of an 8 and a 12 at the same time.
Mm.
And that seems to be like a conversion thing between the two calendars. So yeah, I'm kind of... If someone says that Quinine in the Voynich manuscript is all about calendars and astronomical timing, I'd say, yeah, I think you're probably right. I couldn't disagree with that.
And do you have any theories about what the information could be contained? What does it tell us?
I think you have to remember that the state of knowledge about astronomy and cosmology in general was fairly flexible back then, and people didn't really have it nailed. And the idea that things were a very common theme in Voynich study, you'll find that people say, oh, because it's hidden, it must be heresy. Or because it's hidden, it must be dangerous.
Mm.
I don't think so. I think because it's hidden, it must be valuable.
Exactly.
But that doesn't necessarily mean heretical or dangerous or something. Someone thinks this is a new thing. And I think it's more like an inventor's type of knowledge than some kind of strange Da Vinci Code type nonsense. This is the secret of the Templars, la-di-da-di-da. You know, but a lot of people do.
Mm.
A lot of people look at this stuff and go, oh, that must be the Templars, or that must be the Cathars, or,
right,
you know, insert name here, you know.
Yes, exactly. There are some other references to, if we talk about some of the other diagrams, a circular one. It has kind of nine, they call it little islands, or whatever, connected by causeways. Do you know which one this is referring
to? That's the nine rosette page I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's the one. Okay. Yeah. And what did you say again in regards to your kind of interpretation of what that might be?
The central rosette depicts something that's really quite strange, that it's... I've been to Venice a couple of times, and I've been up to Campanile, and I've looked down at the Basilica of San Marco from above, and the resemblance is not just coincidence. It's the resemblance of the shapes plus the perspective projection.
That's right. That's what he mentioned. Yes.
And if you go up there and you look down, and you can find plenty of pictures on the internet of tourist pictures looking down at it. And if you look more closely at the shapes, you can see the ridges of the domes that are all embedded in there.
Mm.
So the person that's doing this has put lots of tiny little visual hints in there that say how it works. But it's still not quite true. But all the same, I can't really believe that anyone would find a better match than that view from that place.
And if we compare the different parts, because again, it has these different kind of parts to each other, is there any overall kind of relationship, or do you think that they are more like on various different topics that may tell their own little story, so to speak, but they're not really interconnected or connected between each other? What do you think?
I think that... In the Curse of the Voynich, I basically put forward a theory that the author of the Voynich was an architect called Antonio Avellino, better known as Filarete.
Okay.
Now, one of the things, he was born in Florence, fled there for whatever reason, went to Venice, couldn't find work there, went to Milan. He worked in Rome as well, and I've got a feeling that what this picture is, what the nine rosette page is demonstrating, is some kind of like an architectural CV of places where he's worked, places that he's left his mark. His the famous part of it would be things that, for example, in the castle in Milan, and if I look, I think that there's the towers of Pavia also represented there, and Venice. I think that he's done something in Venice. So, but it's very, very hard to tell. And I have to say that looking at the various pictures, I don't know what they mean. I think that there's some kind of milling machine being represented. Perhaps a water-powered machinery.
Hmm.
If you look at the top middle and the bottom middle, there's a kind of blue and yellow circular shapes, and there's kind of like a lot of arrows or dots or circles coming from them. I think that there's some kind of power, not kind of perpetual motion type power, but just like milling power.
Hmm.
Middle of the 15th century was a key time when industrialization of power sources, using them for sharpening knives, fulling cloth, doing all kinds of replacing manual labor with these machines, was right on the agenda. Canals were being built all over the place, not just for transport, because a canal was like a motorway relative to the force of the roads. But they also for mill races for driving machinery. So I think that this page has all kinds of stuff going on it. There's some kind of machinery thing going on here. There's some kind of thing with Venice in the middle. I think there's some kind of Milan in the top right and Pavia. I don't know.
Mm.
It's very hard to say, but I'm pretty sure that that's the kind of thing that's going on. In the end, I'd be delighted if someone disproved my theory about Filarity.
Yeah.
I'll be able to scan it because it will take a great weight off my mind.
Filarity, of course, is Antonio Averlino, which, and how much have you studied him? Because what I've stumbled upon right away, that it says that he was potentially expelled from Rome after being accused of attempting to steal the head of John the Baptist.
That's right, yeah. You remember that John the Baptist was the patron saint of Florence. And so when there was talk of a plot to steal, no, there was another Saint John in whose remains were in Rome. It's actually a different Saint John. But in the early part of the 15th century, it was believed that they were the same St. John, that the St. John the Baptist was, his remains were in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was talk of a plot of stealing the reliquary holding these the remains. And a load of people said that. And then basically Avellino ends up carrying the can for the whole thing. And he said, "That wasn't me, it wasn't me. You know, I've got nothing to do with it."
Uh-huh. What do you think they accused him?
Well, he was one of the Florentines in town. And there's talk of a Florentine plot. And chances are the other people in the plot were just too powerful to get rid of. And someone had to carry the can. And he drew the short straw.
He was the one, huh? Hmm.
Yeah, so they threw him in jail. And he sent off loads of furious letters to Florence saying, "Look, you know it wasn't me. You know it wasn't me. Get me the hell out of here." And after about a year, they did. And it was ostensibly to finish his work on, I think it was the Cardinal from Portugal, his tomb. But instead of finishing it, he just legged it and just ran away. And I can't say I blame him.
Okay.
The prisons in Rome were much to write home about.
You know, maybe we can talk a little bit about, there's two different kind of codes I'd like to ask you about. One of them is the Enigma code, and one is the Cryptos code, of course. But if we begin with the Enigma code and talk a little bit about the one who broke that, Alan Turing, have you studied him
at all? Oh, yes, Turing, yeah.
The guy who's said, in a way, to be behind the modern computer even, right?
That's right. Turing was a fascinating character, but really suffered, you know, with his homosexuality was a big problem for him. And it was made to be a problem for him. I don't know. I always feel when I read about him that the full story, no one's really captured the full story of it.
Mm.
And I think, you know, he is an extraordinarily bright bloke that, and very clear-sighted in lots of ways, but very compromised and caught up within a whole lot of stuff that was just that he couldn't control and could never control. And, you know, I think it's one of those things where kind of proves that brains don't hold the day every time. And life is a lot more complicated. You need to be a master of, you know, more than just your brain.
Yes.
To do well.
Do you think he? Because you mentioned something interesting in the first hour, where you basically said every of the at least the Nazi, you know, code started with Heil Hitler, which means that, do you think the Enigma code wasn't that difficult to break after all then, or how do you think Alan Turing went breaking that?
The history of Enigma was that there was an Enigma machine that was invented before the war, and some Polish, I think the mathematicians in the Polish army, I can't think of the names, but they worked out how it worked, and they did an awful lot of work on it, on how you go about breaking it, and pass it over to the British, but basically they got killed, I think, right at the start of the war.
Mm.
Because, you know, Poland was the first place where the tanks went in. So, that was you know, 70 years ago this year.
And
a lot of the start had been given by Polish mathematicians, and Turing then developed the bomb, which is basically the first kind of problem-solving computer on a large scale.
Yes.
I mean, people have developed mathematical machines for centuries, literally for centuries. I think it was it Pascal or Descartes who invented one, and a mathematics machine, a calculator type thing.
Yes.
And was told that nobody would buy it because it would put people out of work.
And, there you go.
And he invented lots of whole sequence of them.
Yes.
That he was told the same thing each time. So people have used mechanical tricks for shortcutting dull calculations for centuries.
Like one thing I just want to bring up to you is the antique Terra mechanism. Have you heard about that?
Of course, yeah.
Yes. What's your take on that?
Oh, antique Terra is very much what the historians say it is now, that it's a zodiacal, astronomical calculating machine that does what it said and does what it says on the side. If you kind of read the right letters,
yes.
That yeah, it's an example of that. But even like millennia earlier,
very early indeed, and it shows also that the knowledge in regards to astronomy and so forth has been definitely known for a long time.
Well, no, it's not strictly the case. Ptolemaic epicycles and things are very much. Have you heard of Fourier analysis?
No, I have not.
Like fast Fourier transform. If you can use as a fast Fourier thing, you can take any signal and then approximate it by sine waves.
Mm-hmm.
So you start with a sine wave and then you add a smaller sine wave and add a smaller sine wave and add a smaller sine wave. And eventually, by adding the right combinations and scaled in the right way, you can simulate any signal. And that's kind of Fourier analysis is basically where you take the signal and work back to those sine waves
mm-hmm.
in a progression. Now, what Ptolemy did was he did a similar sort of thing, but with epicycles, where he simulated the motion of the planets through a series of chain circles, circular motions. They believed, that motion was essentially circular. But because circular motion didn't quite fit the way the planets moved, according to their theory of where they were,
mm-hmm.
that they had to add these epicycles in to kind of offset them and jiggle them around a bit. So what the Antikythera machine mechanism would have done would be to simulate those epicycles to move the planets around.
Like now, scale, a small version of bigger, yeah.
That's right. Now, when Copernicus simulated the motion of the planets around the sun, the circles, he actually produced a worse approximation than Ptolemy's.
Hmm.
But it was more elegant. It's only when Kepler came along and said, well, actually, maybe circles aren't quite the whole story.
Hmm.
And then that led to ellipses. All of a sudden, then the numbers started to make sense. And he used Tycho Brahe's observations to do that. But so, what the Ptolemaic stuff was basically a really good approximation in the way that you can approximate a function with lots of sine waves. He approximated the circular motion, non-circular motion with lots of little circles, all kind of chained together.
Hmm.
And so the machine would have basically been like a clock, kind of, but for circle, but for planet motions of planets.
Yes.
According to their idea of how they worked, which was wrong. But close.
So we touched upon some of the more interesting aspects if you think there is any kind of hidden alchemical clues and so forth in the documentation. And again, there's a lot of different theories out there. But if we move from this area a little bit from the Voynich manuscript and talk a little bit about the Cryptos code, there's a really interesting one as well. This is basically a monument, I guess, outside the CIA. Headquarters, which has been people have been trying to break it for a long time. Have you looked into this as well, Nick?
Yeah, most of my interest is in stuff that's a bit more historical. But I had a look at crypto stuff. The person that's really had the biggest crack at this is, two people, is Ilonka Dunin and Jim Galogli. They're both, and they're the kind of the key people in the modern history of the cryptosculpture and cryptography.
Mm.
It's a great little story, But it's not really my bag, put it that way. That yes, you could create a piece of artwork that is based around cryptography, and yes, you could genuinely hide messages in it. But it's a bit. It's not really mysterious, is it? It's more the nature of an art puzzle. I prefer the mystery end.
But as far as you're concerned, do you think that has been solved?
I think most of it. Most of it has been. The final one hasn't been. The final one of the set.
There is four solutions, I think, to it, and part four is unknown, right? Is that it?
That's right. It's the last one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's I'm a bit more of a history bot. I'm more interested in things that are from dead people. And the guy's very much alive. Last time I looked.
So what are some of the other ones then that you've been looking into? Because I guess generally now on your website, you follow a lot of CypherMysteries.com. You follow a lot of different ciphers and different kind of mysteries that come up. You know, in regards to different not only manuscripts but other generally crypts and ciphers and so forth. Is there anyone else that you are very interested in that you haven't been able to solve, or that holds kind of a similar, I guess, weight as the Voynichship manuscript does?
I've got one that I'm going to be posting around later in the year that's possibly even bigger than the Voynich manuscript, but I'm still working on that. And so I'll hold back a little bit on that.
Hold back on that one. So, okay. Is there any other ones, a few that you want to talk about?
There's a lovely one from... A beautiful one from Australia. Now, normally I do like older cipher mysteries, but this Australian one from 1948 is fantastic. It's called the Tamman Shud cipher mystery. Mm. Basically, this corpse turns up, and there's bits of paper and people in a copy of a thing by Omar Khayyam, and there's just all kinds of little pieces to it that don't really make any sense at all. And the person's had all their name tags removed. And there's people it could be, but it isn't. Oh, it's a lovely little mystery. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it no justice at all.
How about the... There's something else mentioned on the website called the... I don't know if I pronounce this correctly. The
Adrenalini Brothers.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us about that.
it's hilarious. Once upon a time, it's a kid's cartoon, and it's called the Adrenalini Brothers. And there's three of them, and they basically a lot of cartoons. They don't speak in any recognizable language, so that they can sell it in all different countries without actually having to translate the language, the talk. So they speak in a language called Rendosian. So Ufa Vami Bakish is, you can't get anything right. For example. Anyway, they talk all this nonsense.
Yeah.
But in one of the episodes, they had a book which is all about escapology. But all the text in it is written in a cipher. I looked at this and I thought, that's got to be a simple cipher. And so I worked it out, and it was just a load of nonsense, but it was like hilarious nonsense. It says, Houdini, etc., sponge bath testes. What? And then, this man used to eat kids. Sick, eh?
And that's it?
That's it. And then the cartoonists emailed me and said, I'm so glad we didn't put anything more offensive.
All right, there you go. But that's an example in other ways in how you can hide language, so to speak, and you can hide a message in codings, yeah, exactly. And this is a more fun example of it. But but again, I mean, there must be thousands and different versions of this out there that obviously has been cracked and so forth from that time on. But it seems to me that a lot of people are you know, involved in this process as well in terms of intelligence, war communication, and things like that? Or do you think that everything these days are just handled by computers and digitized, so to speak, encryption? Or do you think there's still some of the more older manual styles of this actually superior to what the computer can accomplish today?
Well, you have to remember that in the world of intelligence, there's an awful lot of propaganda, an awful lot of nonsense, and a lot of things often used to hide other things. Like the notion that Al-Qaeda hid things, messages in steganography,
mm-hmm.
hiding pictures, messages in pictures.
Yeah.
I suspect that was kicked off by a steganography company trying to get some trade. I don't actually believe for a minute that Al-Qaeda ever hid anything in any pictures.
Yeah.
It just makes no sense to me. It's just not their style. It's not their kind of thing. You know, the Al-Qaeda world is just not connected up that way.
Why do you think this... Was it a private company that gave this impression or started this rumor?
I guess it was. I mean, there were a few steganography startups
yeah.
that stood to benefit from the attention, and obviously it was one of them. You know, it may seem a little bit pessimistic of me to say that, but I don't really see that Al-Qaeda hid anything.
Yeah.
There was talk, you know, in 9/11, there was talk of they used a code word for it, for the attacks, which was Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the Porsche 911, that's so they couldn't forget. Okay, so it may well be that they chose the date and they said, hey, well, that's actually quite a good way of remembering it. And they talked about it in the conversations.
Well, we have our theories about who's behind 9/11 anyway. And I mean,
I'm not pressing that button.
That is interesting,
there were like allegedly phone conversations where they mentioned portions.
And
some of the interrogations that were published seem to support this. But I don't know. I mean, it's just one of those things.
Who knows?
So that's fairly low level stuff.
Yes.
And I think it's not hiding things in a very clever way, but it was clever enough to. Get a jump on the entire U.S. intelligence services. So yeah, you have to remember, it's like being a con artist. People think that to be a con artist, you have to be clever. Actually, it's not true. You just have to be cleverer than your victim.
Yeah, that's right.
And being clever than the U.S. intelligence service may not have been much of a challenge.
Is there anything more here towards the end here as we begin to wrap things up, Nick, in regards to either the Voynich manuscript or cryptography or stenography that we haven't talked about yet that you'd like to mention?
I think wrapping it up, I'd say that when I used the tools of intellectual history to try and work out who made the Voynich manuscript, and I came up with one name. Yeah, I could well be wrong, but I would be very, very surprised if the person who turns out to have done it wasn't remarkably similar, basically like a twin brother to
mm-hmm.
Filarity.
Mm-hmm.
That when you check off the list of things that describe the Voynich manuscript, it turned out to be an aspirational text of book of secrets with all kinds of different things in. To further an individual's personal agenda, that it's from the mid-Quattrocento by probably almost certainly northern Italy. It's all these things that I think will turn out to be the signature of the author. And but I could well be wrong, but I think I've basically profiled him. I feel like I've done the criminal profiling.
There you go, CSI or whatever it's called.
Absolutely.
But yeah. what, again, in regards to this documentary that you mentioned that is coming out, do you know what channel is producing this? Is it History of Discovery or someone like that?
I think they've got links with the Smithsonian Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, was it RTL? Is it in France? RTE.
RTE in France is doing this the documentary on this.
It's a co-production between a number of different countries.
Okay.
So it's, you know, they've got big backing and they're doing quite a lavish production job on it, allegedly.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it'll be quite pretty. But really, the problem they've got is that the real interesting stuff for the Voynich happens not after the Rudolf Second Court, but before it. And on that, the books are entirely silent. Mm. The archives are silent.
We'll just have to see as well then what that documentary goes into, and if they indeed even touch upon that. We'll just have to see, I guess, when it's out.
Just have to see. Yeah, yes. It'll be next year. But yeah, what's more interesting for me is that they've done the dating evidence. They've done the dating tests.
Yeah.
And we'll see what they say.
And we'll see if it might confirm something that you found as well here then. There might be some collaborating evidence here, so to speak. We'll see what happens.
I have to remember that I don't know what tests they've done.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
So they could produce any kind of data. We'll
but see. Again, you were there, right? And you looked at the document yourself. And those, because there's two different versions. One is obviously the real one, and then there has been a copy of the real one. Do you know if that is identical, or is there any difference between the two?
I think that it was not copied in the way people think it was copied. I think it's still the original document, but that when the enciphering was done, I think it was done in stages on a wax tablet. And then it was copied from the wax tablet, page at a time. So you have probably two people. You'd have one person with the wax tablet who would write down the text, then perform the transformations on it.
Mm.
And then another person, then he'd hand the wax tablet off to another person who would write that down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sense in which it's a copy. And that accounts for the low number of copying errors and things like that.
Yes.
But I don't think it's a kind of a... And the original document, I think, was unenciphered. So, you know, if you encipher a document with pictures, is that a copy?
Hmm. No, not really.
Well, you see, if you have an intermediate stage where the text is enciphered on a wax tablet, is it a copy of that wax tablet? Pretty much. So there you go.
Well, I guess we'll have to see again here then, and see what comes out of this documentary. But in the meantime, people can check out your website, of course, cyphermysteries.com, and the book title again is
Curse of the Voynich.
Curse of the Voynich: The Secret History of the World's Most Mysterious Manuscript. I want to thank you very much for your time, Nick. It was really interesting having you on the program and talking about some of the different ciphering mysteries as well. So thank you very much for that.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
All right. That's our program with Nick Pelling. Thank you very much for joining us. Stay tuned for more radio coming up with Ellen Brown. We have our part two with Andrew Bashago coming up as well. We're also going to be joined by Kevin P. Miller talking about his film Generation RX. And David Icke will join us to talk about the whole swine flu issue and vaccinations. So do stay tuned to Red Eyes Radio. Thank you again for joining us. Take good care. And in the meantime, we'll see you online.